So this year, 2018, is the 20th anniversary of my pulpit exchange with a Methodist minister in the village of Edgeworth in Lancashire, England. Some of you here will remember that occasion, how in the summer of 1998, our family went over to the UK for the first time together as a family and enjoyed possibly the worst summer weather in memory. In Britain, that is impressively bad. All the while, my counterpart here experienced one of the nicest summers on record. And I still remember briefly meeting in the airport as we each headed home. He and his family were tanned and beautiful. Us, pale, with colds, slightly wrinkled from the weather, you know. Of course, it doesn't need to be said, but just, I hold no grudges. After all, love keeps no record of wrongs, and I've just let go of the entire injustice of the whole thing. One of the more interesting things for me when traveling in places where English is the common language is listening for word differences. You know, tomato, tomato, and aluminum, aluminium. This is one that I find interesting. Adidas, Adidas. Who knew? And then, of course, there are the differences in expressions and in idiom. In that summer of 1998 that felt like winter, like I just said, it's all water under the bridge. No, I've just let it go. We came across an expression that did stick with us. You're a star. We heard it all over the place that summer. You know, you're a star, meaning thank you for the kindness. So here, let me help you with that response would be, oh, you're a star. So that's an expression we actually brought back with us, and we still use it occasionally around our house. And I got to thinking about it again this week because of the connection with the celebration of Epiphany. You remember that, of course, a star is a key element of the story. For the Magi, the wise men, they followed a star that led them to Jesus. So welcome to the season of Epiphany. That word epiphany is a modern-day variation on the Greek word for manifestation. And an epiphany being typically a manifestation, an appearance of the divine in some way. Or it could also, alternatively, it could be a new or a sudden insight into the meaning of something. I've had an epiphany. In the church, yesterday, January 6th, that is officially celebrated as the Feast of the Epiphany, and that begins in our part of the church world anyway, the season of Epiphany, which is that period of time leading up to Lent, which this year begins on February 14th, Valentine's Day, incidentally. And all during this season, we read scriptures such as today's, of course, the arrival of the Magi. And then there's, of course, the baptism of Jesus and the wedding feast at Cana and more. And all our texts that refer to Jesus, to God and Jesus, and how Jesus manifested God to us, revealed to us, provides this epiphany. So as I said, we're celebrating the Feast of the Epiphany today. We would have done so yesterday, but for some reason, you weren't here. I was on my own. Not that I keep a record of wrongs. No, I'm just kidding. I wasn't here yesterday. But yesterday was officially Epiphany. And so our gospel reading today is about the Magi's search for this newborn king, and there's loads of tradition associated with the arrival of the Magi, which is actually the biblical term used to name and describe these travelers, these spiritual seekers. They were astrologers, magicians, hence Magi. They were really the scientists of the day, certainly seekers of wisdom, which is probably how they often get referred to as the wise men in good number of biblical translations. Though the actual Greek word, of course, is magos, which is from where we get our English word magi, magician, and the like. They are also sometimes named as the three kings, which is in part probably a reference to or an attempt to connect to the first half dozen verses of the Isaiah 60 passage that Audrey read to us this morning. you heard it in that verse, nations shall come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn. That was the third verse. And then in the final verse, there's also another connection. They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord. But in Matthew's gospel, they're not actually called kings, but magi. And curiously, it doesn't actually mention their number, just that they brought three gifts, adding myrrh to the first two listed in Isaiah. And so I guess it's possible that there were actually four magi, and one of them left the gift of Apple stock certificates at home. Darn it. Or that there were just two, and they pooled their resources and said, look, we can afford three. But who knows? It's not really essential to the story, and three conveniently matches the number of gifts, so I think that's a reasonable number for us to use. You'll also have noticed that despite our observance of the Magi's arrival on Epiphany, 12 days after Christmas, that culturally we tend to place them at the manger scene on Christmas Day, which isn't necessarily what the scriptures describe, though I suppose it's possible. Our first verse says that wise men from the east came to Jerusalem after Jesus was born in Bethlehem. And how long after just isn't stated. It could be minutes, I suppose, but being that there's like a 10-kilometer trip from Jerusalem south to Bethlehem, it's probably safe to say that it's not likely that they were wrestling for space around the manger with the shepherds, who were the only visitors that Luke actually mentions. By the way, one of the ways to observe this in your homes is to place the Magi in your nativity set in a different part of the house and then move them closer and closer through each of the 12 days of Christmas, having them arrive on Epiphany. And I rather like that tradition because it highlights Christmas as a season, not just as a day. But anyway, as we heard in our gospel reading this morning, the Magi, they arrive in Jerusalem and they go to visit the reigning monarch, Herod, to find out what he knows about this newborn king, because they've observed some celestial activity indicating a birth. And there's a logic to their actions. If you want to find a king, you should go to a palace, right? It also is evidence of their naivete. They might have factored into that decision some awareness that kings are often a little sensitive to competition. And certainly this information about this royal newborn sets a wave of paranoia loose in the palace. A fear that will eventually have deadly consequences for those babies who are unfortunate enough to have been born in Bethlehem during that time. I imagine that Herod offers up to the Magi a lunch or tour of the palace or some such thing, keep them occupied, because while they're away, he calls his advisors together and they tell him that there is indeed some scriptural support for the possibility of a ruler being born in Bethlehem. And so then Herod calls the Magi back, and in my mind, in some rather oily way, he suggests that when they found this wee lad, they should come on back to the palace and he too will stop by and offer his peculiar congratulations to this threat to his power. Because that's exactly how Herod saw this newborn, a threat to his power. Remember that Herod actually murdered three of his own sons to protect his position. He was notoriously paranoid about any threats to his kingship. Hence, the Emperor Augustus quipped this about Herod. He said, it's better to be Herod's pig than his son. As we hear the Magi follow the star to Bethlehem and the house of the Holy Family, it does say house, dwelling. It doesn't say stable, which further messes up my nativity scene, I might add. And that's where Matthew says that they paid Jesus homage, which is kind of a quaint term. I don't use it very often in common parlance, homage. But it means that they revered him. They probably bowed down to the child. That's usually what homage means. Then they gave him the three gifts, after which they returned to their own country without passing through Jerusalem, having had a dream warning them of Herod's treacherous intentions. Now, I was thinking about this passage this week, and I couldn't help but do some comparison between Luke and Matthew's accounts of these visitors to the newborn babe, Jesus. The visits are so totally different. The visitors have different status and situation and even motivation, I suspect. In Luke's story, the first visitors, of course, are the shepherds. And they were out there washing their socks by night. And as the carol goes, seated on the ground. And they experience this spectacular display of God's glory through this angelic multitude. And then they're quickly dispatched to the manger where they meet Jesus. And what strikes me about this is it all happens so suddenly and without warning. They get to meet Jesus, God born in human likeness, to quote St. Paul. Even though to that point they'd just been minding their own business on a hillside somewhere. But that activity is completely blown apart when God essentially says to them, "Look at me. I'm marching into your life now in a most extraordinary way." And it's also swift and unexpected. They weren't planning on this at all. On the other hand, in Matthew's gospel, we get the Magi, scholars from somewhere in the east, and we don't know where. It could be as far east as China, for all we know. But these seekers of truth discern through the stars that someone of massive consequence is being born. Somewhere. And in my mind, I imagine the bunch of them, they're having coffee one morning, and one of them says to the other, "Hey, have you guys been noticing the skies lately? It's like there's something big going to happen." And they talk and they talk and they reflect and they say, "Okay, let's figure this out. Road trip?" And off they go. And travel in those days, travel was no small risk. Which suggests to me that they were powerfully driven or drawn in some way simply to know. Do they understand they're heading to Bethlehem? I rather doubt it. They're just following the star. They're on a journey. They're on a quest to find this new king. This new king who must be really something. There's lots of kings during that time. So what's so special about this one? There's something driving them, something drawing them. What is clear is that they're seekers. They're on this quest for truth. They want to meet this king. And weeks, months, perhaps years pass, we don't know. But their search leads them to Judea and to Jerusalem and finally to Bethlehem, where they meet Mary and Joseph and the baby. And for some reason, perhaps in some way related to having learned some other things, on this long journey to meet Jesus, they actually worship him. All of which makes me ask, how did you come to meet Jesus? Was it that you were minding your own business, doing something mundane, and in some way metaphorically sitting on a hillside somewhere, watching your flocks, and suddenly there was this powerful, life-changing moment where God just reached out to you and grabbed your attention? Some of you have actually told me stories of having just that kind of experience. You had this moment when God just spoke to you and suddenly you knew. It was as if the heavens opened and there it was, the glory of God. And perhaps you weren't even sure you knew what you knew. But in some way now, you know that in that moment, Jesus wasn't just some sort of historical character, but that he had been raised, not just from the dead, but had been raised into your heart. And so it was like being born all over again. Praise be to God. Or maybe it was something more like the Magi. There was some vague stirring somewhere, some hint that there was something going on somewhere. And you began a journey, a lengthier journey than a sprint from a small hillside somewhere to a town somewhere. It began a much longer trek, lots of stops along the way, asking for directions, one that eventually brought you here to some other community like this. There are different ways to come to Christ, to find him. And as I think about my own experience, I see elements of both shepherds and magi, because I was raised in the church, but I was by no means at any manger, I can promise you that. I was on a journey, a quest, I guess. And then one day God just kind of barged into my perfectly ordered life and upset everything. And then the journey continued to that house in Bethlehem to meet the great disruptor, Jesus. And continues to this day. We all live varied lives. And those lives lead us to find ourselves in some interesting places. So, I mean, mine is extraordinarily interesting. On a typical week, I find myself in all sorts of exotic locations. I meet all sorts of fascinating and unusual people. I'm not just here, but I also go uptown and I shop at QF. I go to the bakery multiple times. I go to other businesses in the community. Shout out to Hebrews Calling, don't worry. And hey, usually once a week, I get to travel to that great cultural mecca, Nanaimo. And I bump into all sorts of glamorous and interesting people, some of whom I suspect are magi, or at least like the magi, in that they're seekers of truth. Occasionally, someone will ask me for directions. They're journeying somewhere and they need someone to help them get their bearings. Though I confess, I probably need to pay more attention than I often do, because sometimes I miss hearing those requests. In fact, sometimes they're not even sure what their questions are. But they're looking, they're searching. And I know this experience is true for you too. There's lots of people around us seeking, looking for something. I dare say, to quote King Herod, searching diligently for the child. And so you stop and you talk and you give them some of your time. And maybe you're able to guide them a bit. Not to lecture them or make sure they get their theology all correct. I found that's not usually terribly effective. But to in some way say, he's this way. You know, it's kind of like you. Can you believe this? That God would use you this way? But it's kind of like you're a star. You're the star. Huh. Praise be to God. Amen.